From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We all have our own take on food.
Chocolate lava cake is not just undercooked chocolate cake. That's not what makes the center molten. You take a frozen cylinder of ganache and you set it in the ramekin so that as the outside cooks fully, the inside becomes molten.
How does a food writer's race or gender shape the way we think about what we eat? Today we hear from a panel of women who say we need more diversity among food writers. First, though, I want to return to a conversation we had about tipping. Researcher Zach Brewster of Wayne State University joined us to share what race has to do with gratuities.
African Americans, compared to white, are on average less familiar with this 15 to 20% tipping norm. They tend to tip on average less than whites. But also it's the case that service makes a difference. So even if customers' perceptions of service quality are not sensitive to service discrimination, there are obviously going to be times where African Americans are not given as good a service, and their tips are going to reflect that.
What do you think about the low-wage tipped income model? Here are your first thoughts. Catherine Napkina of Savannah reached out on Facebook. She says, like many young actors, my daughter did stints as waitstaff in restaurants and as cast slash waiter slash bartender in dinner theater. I think few people understand that waiters are not really paid and tips are their income. I've never forgotten shock on my husband's face when our daughter lent him a book with a check stub for $0 from her restaurant. So yes, a good waiter in a good restaurant can bring down great bucks, but for many, it's an edgy existence. I also wanted to know if you'd ever come across a tip jar you felt was out of place, and we got an interesting answer to this one.
Hey Celeste, this is Nick Baum, Savannah. The most egregious example I've seen of this is along the same lines. It was when I was riding a bus in Savannah. There was actually a box at the front of the bus asking people to donate school supplies. The most abject and forlorn in any society, our bus riders are now being asked to stock our public schools. It's incredible.
Not exactly a tip jar, but we understand the correlation, Nick. Thanks for your call, and we love to get calls from all of you. Nick reached us at 404-500-9457. Catherine posted on Facebook, and you can reach us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. For years, Atlanta has worked to fix failing public schools. Charter schools have begun to appear as an alternative to many of those troubled schools. In author David Osborne's latest book, Reinventing America's Schools, he suggests all schools follow charter school-like guidelines. I spoke with him and Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Maureen Downey. So, David, let's start with the parts of the charter school that you think should be emulated or repeated throughout the public school system. Which part?
Well, there are several. The first is autonomy. Let the people who run the school actually run the school. People don't realize that in a traditional urban district, principals often can't select their teachers. They can't fire their teachers because of tenure. They have no control over the pay scale, and they can't fiddle with the educational model very much. So they don't have the ability to change the school and turn it around. People running charters do. So that autonomy is first. And then
can we just test that autonomy here really quickly? Mm-hmm. First, because autonomy, how far do you want that to go? Because there has to be oversight. And we have seen in some charter schools places in which insufficient oversight has gone badly wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There has to be oversight. There are still some rules. There are things that charters are not allowed to do, such as discriminate, such as choose, handpick their kids. But in places where there isn't oversight and they don't have accountability, that is, the overseer doesn't close the ones that are failing, then charter schools are not much better than the traditional schools. In places that do that, where they have active oversight and the really weak schools get replaced by better operators, that's where you see really high performance in the charter sector.
Maureen, what's your response? Do Atlanta Public Schools not have this kind of local control that David's talking about?
You know, even some of the charter schools in Georgia across APS and the entire state don't have some of the freedom that David's talking about because they're district chartered. So I think the schools that have the most freedom, the kind that David means, are the schools that are what I would call startup charters. So they started from scratch. They had been separate from the district all along. I think my concern about David's theory is that everything, or David's recommendation, is that if everything worked as it was supposed to, which is what makes would make the charter plan work, everyone has to be doing their job well, and the right people have to be in their jobs. If we can make that happen, we can make that happen under the current setting as well. Even traditional public schools, as we know them now, could be successful if everyone was doing their job at the high level that he recommends in his book.
I actually disagree with that, with all due respect. I think our problem is not so much the people in traditional public school districts. I think most, 99.9% of them are dedicated, hardworking, trying to help the kids. The problem is they're trapped in a system that was designed over a century ago. We're using an organizational model called bureaucracy. It's centralized, it's hierarchical, it's rule-driven, and it just, in any sector of American society today, it doesn't perform very well anymore.
I want to play a comment from David Mitchell. He is with the group Better Outcomes for Our Kids. And one of the complaints that he has about charter schools is that they can cause racial divides. Take a listen.
We believe in a lot of this charter movement in Atlanta, particularly in communities that don't have the white flight issue. It's black people, and then there's more black people. Don't even understand that there are options out there for them. And so when these schools like KIPP or Kadesi or others that have come into the community, what has happened is they have felt like this movement has happened to them and not with them.
So, David, we're going to get down your list of recommendations. So what's your response to this? Because we have seen this occur in communities in which charter schools are seen as an sort of an alternative to that segregates kids as opposed to private schools.
Yeah, and I think that's really unfortunate. That is an issue in the South that isn't the case in most of the rest of the country. We should be using charter schools and choice to integrate the schools, not to segregate the schools. And it's the responsibility of the charter authorizers, if that's the state or if it's a district, to try to prevent that and promote integration.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with, we're talking about charter schools and how what we might learn from them and then integrate into the public schools. David Osborne is the author of Reinventing America's Schools, and Maureen Downey is the education reporter and writes the Get Schooled blog on the AJC. All right, so we talked about greater autonomy. What other things do you think charter schools have that public schools should have?
The key, well, charters are public schools. It's a question of whether we're talking about 20th century public schools or 21st.
Okay.
The second thing is accountability. We let, too often in traditional districts, we let failing schools, high schools where 50% of the kids are dropping out, we let them go on year after year after year. In the charter sector, if it's done according to how charters are supposed to be run, you get typically 5 years. That's your charter is a performance contract for 5 years. And if the kids are falling behind grade level too far, your charter is not renewed and you close. And that changes everything. You know, all of us...
If it happens, it changes everything.
If it happens, absolutely. And in the places where it doesn't happen, we don't get high performance.
Right.
So I totally agree with that. It's critical. And it's beginning in the district sector, too. I mean, the districts are changing. But... you know, there's a reason that the cities I write about, New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Denver, are the fastest improving cities in the country. And the reason is they give their schools autonomy, and then if they're not succeeding, they replace them with a much stronger operator.
The difficulty being that the vast majority of charter schools, 37% of them do worse than their public schools, and something like, I think, almost half of them do pretty much exactly the same.
That's data from 2009, which was on a study that ended in 2007 or 2008. The same organization, which is at Stanford University, has done updated studies. In 2015, they did a study of 42 urban areas, and it said that when a kid is in their fourth year in a charter, they're learning, they're getting an extra half a year of learning every year compared to the same kid demographically with the same past test scores in a district school.
Maureen, do the traditional public schools not have the accountability that charter schools do?
Well, you know, again, there's practice, and then there is what is supposed to happen. You know, I would say that in speaking in Georgia now, I think we have about the same accountability here for our traditional schools and our charter schools. We've been very careful, and our charters have not been approved at the rate of some of the states, Ohio, for example, or Michigan. So I think we have charter schools that are, in fact, are doing okay, and we're not closing a lot of them. When charters come up for renewal, it happens everywhere, not just in Georgia. One of the problems I have is that parents like their schools. Parents like schools aren't doing so well. And we've had pressure from charter school parents to keep open schools that are not doing so well. And I think that it's the same standard with the public schools. We have public schools that aren't doing so well, but there's no clamor from the parents for the state to come in and take over those schools. In fact, there is resistance of parents.
Yeah, they voted down the plan, Governor Nathan Deal's plan, that would have done
right.
that.
So I think that what we have here is a situation where I think that there is a parent factor that has to be weighted, whether talking any kind of public school, and that is what parents perceive their school versus what we label the school as failing, which in Georgia is largely on test scores. And David, in your book, you actually say we should step back from that a little bit. Mm-hmm. If we step back from test scores in Georgia, we would have fewer failing schools across the board, charter and traditional. The thing I want to talk about with David's book is that it to me, the charter movement, particularly in New Orleans, Washington, and Denver, it relies on an infusion of very young, hardworking staff. These are folks who, as you point out in your book, take phone calls at 10 o'clock at night. These are folks who will never stop trying, who give far more than the standard hours.
Yeah.
And you know, Dr. Haberman out of University of Milwaukee once described those teachers as missionaries, and I think you use that term in your book as well. Can we build a system, is my question, on where we're asking people to essentially burn themselves out?
Yeah.
And I know that charter school teachers, some of the who are with these really high-achieving charters, they have had to leave because they cannot simply do 15 hours a day. They can do it at 22 and 25, then they get married and suddenly they can't do it. I think we have to look at how can we build good schools that still allow their staff to have their own lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We have about a minute left, David, and I wanted to allow you to respond to that.
Sure. If you go to Denver and D.C. and New Orleans, they're struggling with this, and they're evolving. And I think part of the solution is technology. Schools are learning how to use online education for math and a few other things to help the kids acquire the content knowledge, and then using the teachers for the more value-added seminars, projects, deeper learning. And I think that's kind of the future, and it's so interesting to watch these places like New Orleans and Denver evolve over time because they definitely struggle with that. But, you know, we really shouldn't we be looking? These cities have doubled the effectiveness of their schools in less than a decade. Shouldn't we be looking at that for some lessons?
That's David Osborne, author of the new book, Reinventing America's Schools. I also talked with Atlanta Journal-Constitution education reporter Maureen Downey. Just ahead, we dig into diversity in food writing. First, though, the music that defines some of our favorite video games. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have you ever wanted your own country? Maybe a micronation is just what you need. A what? Yeah. Some people have formed these, quote, small, self-proclaimed entities which claim to be independent sovereign states but are not acknowledged as such by any recognized sovereign state or by any supranational organization. That's the definition of a micronation. 27 of these self-proclaimed nations, many from Georgia, gathered in Dunwoody last year for MicroCon. It's a 4-day event hosted by Queen Anastasia von Elfberg of Ruritania. Ruritania is near Stone Mountain, and I talked about this epic gathering with filmmaker Oliver Noble of Vice Media. His documentary chronicled MicroCon.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. And Ryan Lenz is with us as well, an investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks.
Oliver, what makes a MicroCon convention good documentary fodder? I assume you didn't go there to sort of poke fun at people.
I mean, no more than they're poking fun at themselves. I think a lot of them have a sense of humor about what they're doing. Some don't particularly, but they're all interesting characters, and that's what attracted me to it. It's also an interesting sort of, they're all interesting experiments in government to a certain extent as well.
So let's actually hear from Queen Anastasia of Ruritania. Again, this is a micronation near Storn Mountain. She's talking here about how she attracts most of her quote-unquote citizens.
We also get a lot of people trying desperately to leave third world countries. They think that we're a country with enough land that they could move here. We can give them a citizenship, but it comes without residency.
Ryan, who are these micronation founders? From what I understand, they're neither necessarily left-leaning or right-leaning. Who are they?
Well, you know, a number of different founders have started micronations for a number of different reasons, and it really depends on, you know, what they're after. You know, some have created micronations for, you know, theoretical experimentation, a political statement, some sort of artistic expression, or just for fun, you know. But there are those that conduct or that create the concept of a micronation for criminal activity, both on the left and the right. On the left, we've seen people declare micronations to protect, you know, whales and various parts of the ocean. And on the right, we see people create micronations with the idea of subverting the federal government or to be there if and when the federal government fails to stand up as the new America. So, I mean, it's really a broad a wild subsection of the American public who's turned on by this idea.
So let's hear a comment from what sounds like one of the more benign rulers. This is Eric Liss. He's emperor of the Erican Empire. That's American without the M. And here's his sales pitch for joining his micronation.
There are absolutely no tangible benefits to being a member of the Erican Empire. It is purely something that someone can be happy about. Naturally, we do sell banknotes and coins and printable passports and citizenship certificates. But really, it's not a question of tangible benefit. It's a question of just belonging. And when you get right down to it, that's really one of the most powerful things in the world.
So, Oliver, what was the purpose of having a convention of these people? It seems like their whole purpose is to be totally independent, right? So why have a conference?
Well, I think they see it sort of like a UN kind of thing where independent countries still meet and discuss global issues. And a lot of them feel that they can accomplish more by working together. And I think it's also a bit of an excuse for them to all get together and stamp each other's passports and show
Are you speaking metaphorically or do they actually stamp each other's passports?
No, quite literally. Yeah, most of them have passports, and many of them have currency and postage stamps, which I believe are not recognized by the U.S. postal system.
I'm sure they're not.
But if you slap a few on, I think they've been known to go through as well.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Vice documentary producer Oliver Noble, whose voice you just heard, and also Ryan Lenz, an investigative reporter for the SPLC. Oliver, any idea why there are so many of these in Georgia and why the convention was here?
To be honest, I'm not sure that there are that many of them in Georgia. I know the one, Ruritania, which Queen Anastasia is the ruler of, is there. I think a lot of them are all across the country. There's about 300 active ones, and also in Europe and all different parts of the world as well. There were some people there from France, a couple of micronations from Canada were represented. So there may be others in Georgia, but the only one I know of for sure is Ruritania.
All right, so then let's hear again from Queen Anastasia. Again, her country, her micronation is Ruritania. Her real name is Veronica Boritz, and her micronation is near Stone Mountain.
Ruritania is, and all micronations for that matter, are more of a political statement than an ideology. We don't care for the way things are going in the countries we come from. And we think we could do a better job, even if it's just over a postage stamp-sized piece of property.
So, Ryan, when does as far as law enforcement is concerned, when is this going go from something that is sort of benign and amusing to something that's of concern?
Well, I mean, as we just heard, Queen Anastasia says, they left, they started their own country because they were unhappy with, something about the country in which they lived. And that's not that dissimilar from what drives people on the radical right to start, say, sovereign nations unto themselves. There's a growing sovereign citizen movement in this country that has sort of turned on by this idea. Let me tell you a story of a man named James Timothy Turner, who was a commercial fisherman in southern Alabama and in Florida, worked for a time for FEMA, and he bought into this conspiracy theory that after the Civil War, the federal government had never been reconvened in a proper fashion consistent with what the Constitution would demand. And therefore, the federal government before the Civil War began was still dormant and ready to be occupied. So he went about the process of creating that government, recognizing or saying that the federal government in Washington, D.C. was completely illegitimate, in fact, criminal. So he starts what's called the Republic for the United States of America. And it grows to include members basically in all 50 states with elected officials. And what's really started to attract law enforcement attention was when he started to build, the armed services of his government. And then he started to encourage people to trade in RUSA money. And it
RUSA standing for the Republic for the United States of America.
Right, yeah. Yep. And so he ultimately was convicted on several tax evasion charges in 2014, and is now serving a lengthy federal prison term. The idea of disappearing or separating yourself from your host nation to create a nation of your own is both sort of fanciful, based on the stories we've heard today, but also quite dangerous in some ways, because it can turn quite dangerous and quite tense.
Okay, so let's hear again from the Vice Media documentary. This is Kevin Baugh, I think that's how you pronounce it, president of Malasia. He's talking about how he got into all of this.
I wasn't even aware that there were other micronations out there until the advent of the internet. You get out there and start looking around like, whoa, that guy's got his own country, he declared. That guy's got his own country.
So, Oliver, what sense did you get? Is there any sense that among those micronations, a certain portion of them are actually thinking about becoming sovereign citizens, actually seriously establishing their own independent republic?
Well, there's certainly a history of that. And like one of the most well-known micronations is Sealand, which was off the coast of, I believe, England, and had a history of sort of subverting laws. And I think even the Pirate Bay, which is a BitTorrenting site, was considering buying Sealand at one point to try and get around.
I want to make sure everyone's staying with you. You're talking about the Principality of Sealand.
Yes.
That's the Ruff's Tower. It's an offshore platform that they've said is a micronation, not the attraction where you can go see orcas in captivity. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. So there has been that and other cases, but I think that was a little more in the 20th century. And now, at least the people at MicroCon this year did not seem like they were a danger to the government. For example,
although one has
Kevin
to wonder
Baugh,
if you were, would you go to a convention?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, there may be others out there, but from what I saw there, it's a little more tongue in cheek. For example, Kevin Baugh, who you were just hearing that clip from on their site. One of the questions is, do you pay federal taxes? And their answer is no, but we contribute to foreign aid in the same amount as our federal taxes would be. So I think that's essentially their way of saying
their way of paying taxes. But yeah. Ryan, in the minute and a half that we have left, we just talked on this show about sort of a very serious, newly emerging conversation about secession. So at what point do you think we as a nation have to worry about the anti-government sovereign citizen movement?
Well, I mean, we're already worried about it quite seriously. The FBI in 2011 announced that that sovereign citizens were among the nation's top domestic terrorist threats. That, of course, remains to be seen if that holds through the current administration. But sometimes these groups can be very much a threat and a worry for a nation or a community in which they exist. It really all depends on whether they view themselves as sort of, you know, good neighbors, so to speak, or whether they view themselves, in which case their ideas are still, you know, completely unrecognized, or if they see themselves as seceding or removing themselves to form a micronation for the purposes of some political grievance. And then that's the fodder for conflict.
That's filmmaker Oliver Noble of Vice Media. You also heard Ryan Lenz, senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Let's move on from micronations to virtual ones. A video game is kind of like a really complicated recipe, right? Every ingredient is necessary, from the animation to the storyline to the sound effects. For Chris Rickwood of Atlanta, the music is the most important part of any game. He writes music for video games, and he worked on songs for more than 100 of them. His compositions have been as short as 2 minutes and as long as an hour. We asked him to describe a couple of his favorite video game songs that have a connection to the Peach State.
My name is Chris Rickwood, and I'm a composer for video games. The first song I want to talk about is by a band called Bit Brigade. The song is from the game Contra, and it's actually a cover song of the game from the game Contra. Contra is a top-down shooter. You're kind of a Rambo-esque type guy that is dropped into the middle of the jungle, and you're supposed to fight your way into the enemy base and rescue the POWs there. The track is called Jungle, and what's unique about it is these guys, they're four guys from Athens. They formed this rock band, and they're very proficient at their instruments. They have two guitar players, a bass player, and a drummer. So if you go to their live concert, they actually have one guy playing the video game while the band in real time is playing the original soundtrack while the guy's playing the game, just as if it were coming from the game. So if the guy dies, they have to switch gears and play the "Hey, I've died" music. Or if the guy reaches a point where the music speeds up, they have to play it sped up, and a certain bit of nostalgia with it. You know, they're playing music from the games of my youth, things like Contra and Metroid and Castlevania. And just hearing them do them live kind of brings another level of, I don't know, reality and life to the music. My other song that I chose is actually one I've done. The piece of music I picked is a theme song for a video game produced by a company here in Georgia called Tripwire Interactive. The name of the game is Rising Storm. This game was a first-person shooter, and it's a game set in the Pacific Theater of World War II. You play as either a Japanese soldier or a U.S. soldier, and it's set in Iwo Jima and other famous battlegrounds during World War II. The theme I wrote really wanted to capture both kind of the dread of war as well as the honor of it. For the Rising Storm theme, what's fascinating about the score to me was getting an authentic flute player to play on it. I kind of wrote out a semi-shakuhachi part for it, but then the musician really kind of took it and ad-libbed his own part to it and really brought it to life. The music in video games and how it really contributes to the story and the flow of how the player is going to interact with the world to me, is almost as important as the artwork and the, I would almost say, half the experience. Because, you know, if without music, just like movies, you know, scenes are kind of flat without that kind of emotional push that you get from music. What's funny now is when I listen to video games and try to be critical about what I'm hearing, I really try to listen to how music not only affects the emotion, but how it's implemented into the game. For example, I'll see if I could actually break the music system by, you know, going back and forth between worlds where music is supposed to switch, and I'll see if it switches instantly or if there's a nice smooth transition. And so it's a strange thing for me to listen to music in games, because I'm really trying to break it apart and see how a composer has implemented the music into the video game, as well as how well he's composed the music.
That's video game composer Chris Rickwood. He lives in Atlanta. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. Just ahead, bring more women food writers to the table. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. This week marks the 157th anniversary of Georgia's secession from the United States. There are still people who think secession makes sense, and tomorrow we'll talk about some of these new conversations surrounding secession. Should we take them seriously? Let us know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 for that conversation. Let me ask you a personal question. How do you like your barbecue? I would be willing to bet that every single person has a slightly different answer to that question. We all have really different tastes. So you'd think there would be all different kinds of people to write about all the different kinds of tastes. But Kathleen Purvis is food editor for the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina, and she says the food writing industry is too much the same.
For the last decade and longer, the food culture of the South has drawn attention from an often New York-based cadre of writing chefs and chefing writers like a mermaid perched on a red clay reef. And that writing is often focused on a male perspective that's starting to reek of hickory smoke and pig fat. Bourbon, barbecue, and pork belly, God help us, are interesting. I have loved those assignments. But in our rush to embrace those subjects, in our insistence upon putting them front and center in every discussion of Southern culture, are there other subjects that aren't getting covered at all? Try proposing an article on chiffon cake, or the contributions of Henrietta Dull, who wrote the landmark 1928 book Southern Cooking, or household arts like pickling and canning, or the cooking of Mexican grandmothers. I'm glad the South has become so interesting to so many people. I'm delighted, mostly, when New York's hip-hop chef Eddie Wang finds his way to Oxford, Mississippi. I gladly joined the standing ovation for Monique Trong's love letter to Bridges Barbecue Lodge in Shelby, North Carolina. Those voices are rich and rewarding. They liven up the joint. It's just that sometimes I wonder, are female Southern food writers the only cultural group left whom it's okay to treat as tokens? How can you tell the complete story of the South without all of us at the table? When the assignments are pitched, don't relegate the female writers, particularly not the Southern ones, to just preparing the side dishes while the men fire up the pit. Don't just turn to us for the women's perspective, or when you want to read the history of cake. When you dig into the Southern food feast, there are plenty of ways to divide the pie. Just don't forget to give the sisters their half. After all, they probably baked the damn thing.
Kathleen Purvis talked about gender diversity. We wondered if that might also be true when it comes to race. I talked about this with Nicole Taylor, author of The Up South Cookbook, Chasing Dixie in a Brooklyn Kitchen. I also spoke with food and beer writer Dennis Byron and Natalie Kang of the Atlanta-based business Chinese Southern Belle. Natalie, I mean, yours is a very interesting combination of the Chinese Southern Belle. And it seems to me that's a pretty good argument for needing people in the food writing industry, at least, that can understand both of those cultures. How do you think food writing has been here? Do you think it's diverse enough?
Well, I mean, I think the writing, just like the food, reflects us and our experiences. So I use food as a gateway. You know, it connects people. It exposes us to place in history and culture. So it's really when I share about my own experiences and ask others to share and connect with food, it's really a reflection of us. And so since I grew up in Atlanta, and it was a very different place back then with no Asian markets, and I was the only Asian face in school, it has certainly become more diverse, and I'm very excited about that. I mean, now we have the Buford Highway International Corridor, and we have all this interest in different kinds of ethnic food. So I'm certainly excited about the movement towards
now
that.
Now, that's interest in the food, and that's availability of the food. But, Dennis, does that mean we're getting a diverse enough cast of food writers that can appreciate all the different tastes?
There's always room for that. But I don't know if there's a word enough that says, okay, now we're good. There's 50% this and there's 50% that, and we're it's split down the middle. I think it's just what your profession is, and if you do a good job at it, then that will usually diversify itself, be it a good writer or what you specialize in. So, like, I'm in the industry of beer. You call me A.L. Sharpton, actually. Yeah, when I call my government name, I'm usually in trouble or something. But, yeah, A.L.E. Sharpton. And I see it. I'm working in the beer industry, and it's working on diversity, but it doesn't have to be pushed or forced. I just so people's taste buds are really complimented and talked about, I think that's a good start to do it.
Okay. Nicole, let me play you a comment from writer and restaurant owner Eddie Wong. He has a TV show called Wong's World. Many people watch. He travels around the world in that show. He bridges cultures through food. And this is from an interview he did for KPCC in Los Angeles.
I think the most satisfying thing is to be understood. At Bauhaus, if I make a dish and an old grandmother comes in from Flushing and says, you know what, I read about this restaurant and I love it, and it reminds me of Taiwan. That's beautiful. She understands my experience, and I understand hers. When people watch the show and they email me, I get emails, they say, I'm Puerto Rican, or I'm Ecuadorian, or I'm Jamaican, and I'm not just like you, but when I watch the show, I feel like this is my life. That makes me happy. That's why we do this.
What does it mean, Nicole? We've heard a lot of discussion about what it means to have representation, say, in Hollywood, in our movies, in our TVs, and recognizing faces that look like you and sound like you. Does that hold true for food writing as well?
Totally, totally. I mean, when I open up glossy magazines or log onto the internet and I'm going to my favorite food websites and I don't see stories about myself and how I grew up in Georgia, I feel like, wait, hold up. You know, we contributed a lot to American food culture. Where are our stories? So it's totally important, just like it's in Hollywood or in music or any other industry, to have our voices, or more so our stories around food in media, in all types of media.
Okay. So, Natalie, I just kind of want to find out where those limits are. Somebody, the editor of Fusion magazine, tweeted out a picture of an article saying, here's the best dumpling restaurants in New York. And he circled the byline, which was Chris Crowley, who you assume is a white guy. And I think his point is that we often hear people who are not of a culture, maybe did not grow up eating dumplings. Is it possible that there are better prepared people to give reviews on dumplings? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's what's been frustrating, I guess, if we're going to be honest here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I love the work that Nicole is doing. I think it comes down to how we're defining authenticity, who's defining it, and then who are we allowing to say, you know, what is authentic. And what has been a little frustrating in my journey is to see that these different kinds of ethnic foods are becoming popular, but they had to be first legitimized by the white dominant culture. Like some of the events that I've been to, you know, it was like, oh, you know, these are our family recipes, or, you know, we grew up eating different parts of the animal, or we talked about being connected to the land and eating a whole variety of food. But then it had to be legitimized first by the chefs that have the certifications, or they're from New York. And so that's been the disconnect that I've seen, is that there seems to be kind of the gourmetified, or I call it foodist, kind of elitist dynamic that's evolved. And like Nicole has written a lot about, you know, a lot of times it's reflective of the women that have slaved in the kitchen, or primarily, you know, black women that have served up the food, but it's the white men that are paid as professionals. And so I see that disconnect a lot with the new ethnic popularity of food, but at the same time, it's like we're
It's odd to hear some guy who didn't grow up with that food telling you that it's not authentic.
Exactly, and then someone to tell me that I can't be authentically Southern. Like, they hear Chinese Southern Belle, and they're like, you can't be Southern. And so that dissonance is what is, I think, is an opportunity for us to broaden the conversation around authenticity, who's defining it, and who says I can't or cannot be authentic, or what foods can or can't be authentic. And as well as Chinese American food. You know, I mean, I've had people constantly ask me, you know, where can I find authentic food? And, you know, Chinese takeout must not be authentic food. But I'm saying, well, actually, it's part of the Chinese American experience. It is part of our Asian American history that Chinese food like chow mein and chop suey are actually authentic to us, but maybe not to someone in China.
Right. Right. All right. Let's hear.
As Americans.
Let's hear actress Rosie Perez, if we're going to be fully honest, as Natalie said. She was a guest on WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful, and she is Puerto Rican of descent. So this is her talking about the assumptions people make about what she will like.
You know, it's so insulting when people go, do you still eat rice and beans? They wouldn't ask an American, you know, do you still eat meat and potatoes? You know, it's just, why would you ask me that? Is that what you see? You don't see me as a human being first. You see me as rice and beans first. And so therefore, that's why it's insulting.
I wonder, Nicole, how far that goes in terms of what you're expected to cook. And I say that as the descendant of an African-American musician who was expected to write so-called black music for all his life. Mm. Does it also affect what you are expected to make?
Definitely. And what I'm expected to write about. I think there people always look at me and think, oh, you write about food. You're a cookbook author. Tell me about the fried chicken. And I'm happy to do that. But, you know, we are more than just fried chicken. And, you know, when you look at the African-American or the black experience in the South, it's full of seafood. It's full of all kinds of things. And you have the Caribbean. So, yeah, people do expect me to write about black food always. And I'm happy to do that because there are not a lot of voices or a lot of people doing that. But I do think there's room for me to talk about other things. Not only me, other people to talk about stuff beyond just black food ways.
We would love to hear from all of you listening. Where do you go to read about food? What blogs do you follow? And does it matter to you? Do you look at the byline when you're reading a review or reading a piece about food? You can tweet us at OST Talk. My guests are Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast and Atlanta food writers Natalie King and Dennis Byron. Dennis, what difference does this make? It's not that, you know, just because you're a white guy, you can't taste good food or good cooking, right? Mm. So in the end, what difference does it make who's writing about the restaurants, who's writing about the cookbooks?
I think a lot of it has to do also with how much exposure a person gets, or a lot of magazines and websites that are, I guess, seen as legitimate, or a lot of them are white owned, so they think that those bigger magazines are the ones that make it a legitimate comment on what a good dish is, or who makes good, whatever it could be. And I think asking those people who do specialize in certain cuisine, they don't have to be necessarily directly from that country, but to know it and knowing their background, they can specialize in that way as well. It doesn't have to always be about race. But honestly, I had an interesting discussion with one of my cousins, and we're from Jamaica. And I'm asking him, what is the best Jamaican food in Atlanta? You know what I mean? And I'm taking his word a little more because he is from Jamaica. And I think that's one way to go about doing it. And also, American food sometimes is kind of tailored towards, you know, not as creative as palates sometimes. So, like, maybe spices.
That's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
Boring plan.
Yeah. And, you know, Thai food can be kind of dumbed down a little bit to kind of not be as spicy. You know what I mean? Those kind of things. But you just got to kind of dig in the crates. And that's kind of a fun thing itself, is to find those really, really authentic spots that make the food that is reflective of the country they represent.
And here's, I think, would be a really big problem, Natalie, is because to a certain extent, you know, they always call it an educated palate, right? I mean, if you haven't grown up in a culture and therefore haven't grown up eating certain kinds of peppers and certain kinds of spices, it may take you a while to realize what it tastes like when those are cooked properly, right? But you don't get a second chance at that review.
No, I mean, you know, in the end, it's almost like if the food is good, you mm-hmm. know, because we're constantly evolving. If you see food as an embodiment of the people and culture, as I do, you know, you have very rarely you're going to have a culture that is formed in a vacuum. Right? We've got so many different influences, and the influences are exciting and tasty and spicy. Why dismiss it just because we might not think it's authentic? Or because, I mean, I've been to China, and it's been authentically bad Chinese food there, right? I mean, because we don't want MSG, we want healthy, fresh vegetables, you know, things like that that we've adapted here in America. Or there might be Cuban influences or even Jewish or Spanish influences, and it makes it very exciting, and it's reflective of who we are in our cooking and what we've become as Americans. So, I mean, I think it's just an interesting, really dynamic kind of concept if you see food as being an embodiment of our diverse, you know, history. So I think to say, oh, because you didn't grow up in China, you know, your dumpling recipe isn't as authentic, or you are Chinese and speak Mandarin, so you can't cook a really good fried chicken and collard greens, right? I think it's we're going to be missing out, you know, on really good food.
That's
but
a great
at the same
point.
Time, you have mm-hmm. to honor the traditions, right? Because, all right, to put bacon in sushi, for example, or to put something really kind of non-authentic, right, into a dish like sushi or in dumplings, are you being sacrilegious? Are you dishonoring that tradition? You know, and I think it's an important question to ask ourselves as people and for the food.
I agree. We have about a minute left. And Nicole, I wanted to bring you into this because it kind of depresses me to hear Rosie Perez say, would you ask an American, because she's an American? Maybe this is about just expanding. I mean, chop suey is an American dish. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just need to expand what American is when it comes to food.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think that there are so many people, home cooks, restaurateurs, food writers, who are really doing great food and honoring the heritage of different cultures. And I just feel like there just needs to be a shift to those folks. And because I think people are doing it. It's not all negative. I feel like the last few months or the last year or so, we've been talking about the lack of, and there is a true lack of, but for sure, there are people who are celebrating our food in ways that totally uplift it. And I do feel like the tide is changing, and that we can move this conversation forward and move this whole thing around diversity and food forward. If we just look at the folks who are not being talked about, go to blogs and stuff. Yeah.
A little optimism to end the conversation. Nicole Taylor, yeah. author of the Up South Cookbook, food writer Natalie King, also owner of the company Chinese Southern Belle, and Atlanta beer and food writer Dennis Byron, hosts a video web series and blog called Cruisin' for a Bruisin'. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. We talked earlier about charter schools, and we would love to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think charter schools work? And should public schools function more like charters? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.